Welcome to the Sustainability Agenda podcast. My name is Fregal Byrne. Every week I speak to leading sustainability thinkers and practitioners, scientists, economists, NGOs, business leaders and investors. We discuss the sustainability imperative, the key challenges, the latest thinking, and what's working in sustainability, resilience and regeneration. I'm very happy today to welcome back Professor Yanis Yanno to the podcast. Yanis was, in fact, the first guest of the Sustainability Agenda podcast. Yanis is an Associate Professor of Strategy and Entrepreneurship at the London Business School and a leading researcher on business sustainability. His research is focused on understanding whether, how, and the extent to which companies and capital markets can lead on the path towards a sustainable future. He's a global influencer, speaker, and advisor, engaging with top executives around the world. Yanis recently launched a new online London Business School program on sustainability leadership and corporate responsibility. So thank you very much, Yanis, for joining me once again on the Sustainability Agenda podcast.
Thank you very much for having me. It's always a pleasure and a privilege.
Great. So you actually were the very first interview and a few years ago now, a very, very interesting interview it was at the time. And I'd love to just maybe for the audience get a remind us a little bit of your background and maybe what's on your mind at the moment.
Absolutely. So I've been at the London Business School for about 10 years now. Prior to that, I did my studies in the US. I was trained as an undergrad as an economist, and then later on at Harvard Business School, I switched to studying business strategy and management. Since I joined London Business School, all of my work has focused on these big ideas of sustainability, environmental and social responsibility by corporations. And in particular, I'm very interested in really understanding why is it that companies are trying to integrate environmental and social issues into the way they do business? How are they doing it? And in fact, what are the implications in terms of their own performance, but also in terms of the impact that they have on the world of this integration, sustainability integration effort? So the big question that I am particularly concerned with in my work is, what can we learn about strategy and organizations going forward about how businesses can contribute towards finding solutions for the world's most acute global challenges by focusing, by integrating environmental and social issues into the way they do business, into their business models, and into their structures. So what's on my mind is really understanding how companies behave, are embedded in within society, and how are they making these decisions? Because I think companies have a huge potential to have an impact, both positive and negative. And I think it's important to try to understand at least under what conditions and how are they making those decisions that can have a positive impact on society at large.
Great, great. Big question here. Not something that we can necessarily parse in a short amount of time. But what's the best way, do you think, to assess how much progress has actually been made by the corporate sector in terms of the sustainability agenda? There's a lot of momentum, a lot of discussion, the business roundtable talking about, what the purpose of, businesses and so forth, investors, what have you. But how can we really work out, cut through that and say, well, how much has really changed?
Well, I think we need to first understand changes in the context in order to start understanding the changes that companies themselves are undertaking. So I think in the last couple of years, what we have seen is that the pressures on companies have intensified dramatically. And they come quite literally from all angles. Think about millennials and Gen Z, for instance. They enter product and services markets, so that they demand ESG accountability in the products and services that they buy. They enter labor markets, and therefore they demand alignment of purpose as employees of companies. And we also know that there is an intergenerational transfer of wealth that is currently underway from the baby boomers to these younger generations. And therefore, the third component of this pressure is that the millennials and and Gen Zs are going to be putting pressure as investors, and therefore demanding environmentally, socially responsible investment. But that's, of course, only one part of the equation. We have fundamentally the science improving, telling us more. And the more we learn, it seems that the worse these problems are becoming. We have the government slowly but steadily starting to spring into action, adopt more long-term commitments to reduce carbon, more environmental regulations, and more institutional commitment, if you like, towards a more sustainable, more inclusive growth for everyone. And we have this major force, of course, which is called the investor community, whether we talk about asset owners, asset managers, pension funds, and so on, institutional investors, where they are demanding at the very least that companies understand the risks that are being created by these big global challenges, both in the environmental and in the social sphere. So that's the background, right? So these are the pressures that have and continue to be intensifying and therefore become more value relevant for all companies out there. Now, the response has been quite diverse across companies. First of all, it is important to understand that given these pressures, we are going through a period of profound experimentation. There is no one solution fits all, and there is no one right answer that would fit all industries all the time. So companies are going through a period in which they are testing the ground. They try to understand what environmental issues are important for us, what social issues are important for us, how do we rethink our relationship with stakeholders, how do we rethink our relationship with our shareholders and with society at large, and sometimes fundamentally rethinking about the very business model of what it means to be a business in a particular industry. Think about, for instance, the automobile industry. We already see, if you still think about London, for instance, in the UK, we already see companies banning the sale of fossil fuel cars. Now, as you can imagine, that has fundamental implication about what it means to be an automobile company. Do you invest in hybrid cars? Do you invest in electric cars? Or do you go into self-driven cars and then now become a future of mobility sort of company? Now, these are fundamental changes. These are changes that have to do with the identity and the very idea of what a company is and what industry is it in. So I think that in order to measure or perhaps understand progress, it's important to see the distribution, if you like, of responses across companies and see which way this distribution is moving. And in my humble opinion, I think that against the background of these intense pressures, multidimensional and complex pressures, I think the distribution is moving to the right. In other words, we see companies making on the right-hand side of the distribution making much more bold commitments. For instance, look at Microsoft recently, right? It's not just about going to net zero, but it's actually eliminating all the carbon emissions since the company was founded, for instance, right? So you have on the right-hand side of the distribution companies that are being bold, ambitious with their targets and what they're trying to achieve, but also, you have other companies where, at the very least, they are following the leaders and therefore they adopt practices that seem to be emerging as common best practices. For instance, reducing your carbon emissions, gender pay equality, and so on. Those are coming to the forefront as the very minimum that you need to do. So on average, and that was a long way of answering your question, but I think that on average, if we see our companies as a distribution, essentially, I feel that the distribution is moving to the right in terms of raising ambition, raising the standard, and raising what is the minimum acceptable level of engagement on sustainability issues across industries.
Very, very interesting. You talk about the minimum level response to sustainability. Can you talk a little bit about materiality? And I'm just wondering, is it possible that for many companies that their actual ESG mandate or what's material for them could be a very tiny part of what they're actually doing?
Yeah, I mean, materiality is a huge topic, right? But and it's like one of those confusing topics as well, because it touches upon this idea of ESG measurement and standards and ratings and so on. I think the first thing that I should note, though, that the fact that we are talking about materiality in the ESG space already tells us a lot about how quickly this space has moved in terms of reporting and measurement and how important it has become, because materiality is a concept that we, of course, often use in financial accounts, right? So now we're thinking about materiality in the context of ESG, which means that, and that's a very positive sign, that at least some people out there and some organizations and some investors are thinking about ESG issues at the same level and with the same importance, if you like, as we look at financial information. So I welcome, and I think it's extremely encouraging that we have a discussion about materiality within ESG. It shows the level of progress and how quickly we have moved in the right direction. Now, as I'm sure you know, there is no one single definition of materiality. And I think that materiality, to some extent, does depend on your point of view. For instance, on the one hand, we have SASB, the Sustainability Accounting Standards Board, where they're very explicit in saying that we want to look at this from the investor point of view. And therefore, when we talk about materiality, we are looking at financial materiality. In other words, the importance that these ESG factors have on a company's ability to generate financial value. But that's not the only definition. It's one of the different definitions of materiality. Stakeholders, for instance, might have another definition, which is about not only the financial potential of a company, but also the impact that it has on its stakeholders, on the environment, on society, on employees, and so on. Now, there's even more sophisticated definitions, right, that go beyond this dichotomy and say, well, we need to start discussing this idea of dual or double materiality. In other words, understanding a particular ESG issue and its integration by companies in terms of not only its financial performance, but also in terms of its impact on the stakeholders at the same time. So you see, it's almost a holy grail sort of thing, because though that sort of materiality in principle is the one that you like, the one that generates a thriving business and at the same time a business that positively contributes. Of course, it's difficult to define what is this idea of double materiality that would apply across different contexts, across different industries, and so on. Now, again, I think that this, let's call it confusion, perhaps, that exists on these definitions. And this extends, by the way, not only to the idea of materiality, but in general of on this idea of how do we measure ESG. It's, in my view, reflects, in a sense, a race to the top. It's because so many people are interested in this that we have so many rating agencies. It's because we all think that this is important that there are different proposals on the table about not only what is materiality, but also what is a reporting standard. Is it going to be an integrated report? Is it going to be according to SASB? Is it going to be according to the Task Force for Climate-Related Disclosures? Those are all proposals that are currently on the table that advance, in my view, the conversation, highlight different aspects of a very, very difficult problem. And therefore, those are conversations that are frustrating as they might be from in terms of, oh, we don't have one solution, we don't have one standard, we don't have one rating. I think they allow us, before we arrive at that one standard or one rating, to really refine our thinking and really refine the rigor and how solid these measurements are. So I think that all those are a good signs on the way towards eventually, if you like, measuring these issues. And by the way, I don't think that it's a sort of a one-off answer. For instance, let me just take us a little bit outside of the sustainability context. When an analyst evaluates a company, right, in terms of financially, of course it would take account its business model. Of course it would take account into account the structure of the industry in which the company is in, and of course it has to take into account the kind of unique resources and capabilities that the company has. So you see, I just mentioned to you three levels: the industry, the business model, and the underlying resource base of a company. Now, do we have one acceptable way of how to weigh the industry importance versus the business model importance versus the resource importance? Of course we don't. It's up to the individual analyst. It's up to the investor to judge, if you like, how to weigh those factors, even for a company's financial performance. I think when we go into the ESG space, of course, things do complexify, but we need to keep in mind that eventually we're not going to reach one standard or only one single way of understanding these issues, especially when it comes to investment decisions, but also more broadly. Now, it's important to understand that, you know, there might be value in this confusion. In other words, if you're an investor that better understands this data or better understands this materiality, chances are you're going to make better investment decisions. Otherwise, if you go with traditional finance theory, right, if we all trade on the same information and we go to full efficient market, then it becomes extremely difficult for anyone to make money out of this, right? So it's interesting that we're going into this period with the proliferation of data generates proliferation of investment strategies, but very understandably so, because there is, you know, this wealth of data, and people are really trying to capture a very important underlying construct, which is this idea of a company's commitment to ESG.
Very interesting. Now, one area where there's, as you say, considerable momentum, are there a couple of other significant developments, would you say, in the corporate sustainability area since we first spoke?
I think, I'll refer to some recent academic work that we have done in this field, because with my co-author, George Serafim, we tried to really understand what has happened in the last 5 or 6 years in terms of what companies are actually doing in the sustainability space, especially in terms of understanding sustainability as potentially a corporate strategy. And there comes the debate that a lot of people have on their minds these days, which is, well, is this sustainability thing something that companies do as a hygienic factor, as something that's necessary, as something that will merely ensure their survival, or is there outperformance in sustainability? Can it also be a strategy in the traditional sense that not only takes you in the middle of the pack, but takes you in front of the pack, right? It makes you a leader in your industry. Which one is true, and how has that debate evolved across industries in recent years? And what we found in this study is it's a study where we use the entire universe of the MSCI ratings from 2012 to about 2017. And what we found was very interesting. So first of all, we found that across almost all industries in the sample, and there were more than 65 different sectors and industries in the sample, we find what we call convergence. In other words, companies are increasingly adopting a similar set of practices within their industry. There is concentration, in other words, of adoption on particular initiatives across industries. Now, these initiatives need not be the same. In some industries, they might relate to carbon emissions. In others, they might relate to human capital. But what we see is that within industry, there is convergence. What does that mean? It means that we are observing, at least to some degree, the emergence of common best practices. Right? These common best practices might be different across industries, but companies in recent years are increasingly more likely to adopt them because they consider that to be what we talked about earlier, perhaps the bare minimum, what would take you in the middle of the pack. Now, that was very interesting because it showed us that, as I said, across almost all industries, there is this type of convergence, but also it revealed to us that different industries converge on these common practices at different speeds, which is very interesting to ask then, why is that the case? Why is it the case that some industries move faster into establishing common practices versus others? And there, we found some very interesting findings. So the first one is that industries tend to move faster when the industry leaders, in terms of market cap, in other words, the financial leaders, also become sustainability leaders. So this told us essentially that the best of companies in an industry tend to be imitated. So in those industries in which the financial leaders also become sustainability leaders, we observe acceleration of common practices. In other words, it is true what they say that when Unilever or P&G or other big companies commit to these initiatives, to sustainability, is not that they, of course, change their own practices, but they have a catalytic effect on the rate at which their industry progresses towards sustainability. And that's very important because it gives us another angle at which to look at the impact of the world's largest companies and how influential they are beyond the walls of their own organization. Now, other factors that drive this speed of convergence is, of course, the relative materiality of environmental and social issues compared to governance. In other words, if the environmental and social issues are relatively more material, there is more scope of action, and therefore companies are more likely to adopt these practices. And the third factor is stakeholder scrutiny. To what extent, in other words, is the industry under continuous kind of scrutiny for its environmental and social practices, the higher the pressure, the higher the acceleration. So the takeaway there is that not only have we observed the emergence of best practices, but we also now begin to understand why is it the case that some industries move faster than others, and what is the role of big business within that? Now, the last component of this research, which I think is critical also from a strategy point of view, is that after we were able to uncover what is the common best practice, we also were able to then, in comparison, of course, say, well, what was a unique practice, right? Because we now have for every industry a set of initiatives that we have identified as common, and compared to those, we can see, well, are there companies that did something different? So we term those initiatives unique. In other words, they were different from the common best practices in a particular industry. And then we started correlating, if you like, the common best practices and these unique practices with a company's financial performance. So what you find there in terms of, you know, thinking about sustainability as strategy is also very interesting, because the first finding is that if you're a laggard on common practices, in other words, if you don't keep up with that bare minimum, your performance will suffer, right? So this is the first piece of evidence that falling behind the trends in sustainability is going to financially harm you. It's not that you're just going to be the average. It's going to have negative implications on your performance. But we also found that these unique strategies, like that are different from just the common best practice, are the ones that correlate positively with financial performance, especially for those companies that are leaders in the adoption of these unique practices. So what the evidence of this study together tells us, and what is the learnings of, you know, the latest, if you like, from the sustainability data that we have available, and as I mentioned, this is up to 2017, is that sustainability is both a necessary condition, in other words, something that companies need to do, have to do in order to stay in the middle of the pack or stay relevant within their industry. And on top of that, what we know is that companies that want to can and do and differentiate themselves by also adopting unique practices within their industry that remain. In other words, that become very difficult for their competitors to imitate, which is essentially the idea behind competitive advantage. So sustainability is this very interesting domain, if you like, where it's both the best practice and at the same time, it gives you the chance to differentiate yourself and build a competitive advantage.
Very interesting. Very interesting. Where do investors fit in here? And I'm just wondering, did you factor that into your research? And just more generally, speaking to somebody who's quite close to this whole space about sustainability leaders, he noticed a disproportionate number of private companies that are active here, and we have seen aggressive pursuit of by certain kinds of investors after companies that have pursued quite aggressive sustainability an aggressive sustainability agenda.
Yeah, I think the the investor side is very critical as well. It's one of those major forces that is really propelling companies to adopt sustainability practices. But similar to the corporate context, one needs to understand that there is diversity within the investor community as well. There is different incentives, there's different time horizons, there's different ways through which ESG is integrated. As you know, there is positive screening, negative screening, engagement, voting behavior, and so on. So I think when we, again, start talking about the investor community, we need to start talking about the distribution of practices. In other words, what is the direction of travel of the industry as a whole? And I think what we're looking at there is increasing level of commitment, increasing level of understanding, at the very least, that environmental and social issues are risks that need to be taken into consideration. That's why, for instance, in the UK, the government is mandating that pension funds and pension trustees disclose more explicitly how they account for climate risk into their portfolios. I think that's why we look at these very ambitious initiatives, which are extremely positive, like the stewardship code here in the UK, which is not only world class but world leading, clarifying, if you like, or highlighting the role of finance and the finance function as being good stewards of capital. So there's a number of these indications that show the way in terms of sustainability. Now, the issue is that for some of these environmental and social issues, I don't think that, you know, companies are or are not protected depending on their status as public or private companies. For instance, climate change impacts are not going to or disruptions in supply chains or adaptation costs. Those kinds of impacts are not going to distinguish between public and private companies or public and private investors, right?
But the investors may say, actually, you know, we don't care, or, you know, we have the situation where we know the, you know, world's top three asset managers have whatever 300 billion fossil fuel investments. You know, maybe there are a whole wave, maybe the most significant wave of investors don't really care. And of course, you're right, private and public companies are going to face, you know, there's going to be no difference necessarily in the scale of the impact it has. But maybe there will be an impact in terms of investors' willingness to allow companies to, if you frame it that way, to take bold sustainability actions.
Right, but what I'm saying is that if I'm a private investor, how could I not care? Because risk is risk, right? My company, whether private or public, it will still not perform well if it doesn't take the necessary measures, for instance, to protect its supply chain from climate change risk, for instance, or social issues and so on. I think that the risk, or at the very least, and forget about the upside, but the risk is very similar across both types of organizations, unless I'm not understanding your question.
I absolutely understand that. What I'm saying is that, you know, if you're a private company, you can take a longer term focus. You can say, well, sustainability is the right thing. We mightn't be able to show the business case now, but we're willing to do this because we believe, and, you know, it makes sense. And they're not going to have investors interrogating them and saying, well, you know, where's the business case? Can we see the return on investment on, you know, all those kinds of things? So they've got much more scope to take action ahead of the pack.
Yeah, I think that is a good, a plausible theoretical argument. I haven't seen evidence that this is true. I would suspect it might be, at least under some conditions. But I think we need to be acutely aware and not cast the investment or markets in a dark light. Yes, of course, there's going to be investors that greenwash, then label things but don't actually do anything, or maybe they say we care about ESG, but their voting record does not support that, and so on. But I do think we need to be careful in terms of the fact that companies, of course, need to integrate these issues, but in a way that is sophisticated, right? In a way that has discipline in a way that it obviously generates financial returns. In other words, it is not sufficient for companies to say, oh, I'm adopting a long-term point of view, and therefore dealing with this ESG issue today is going to pay off in the long run. You don't wake up one day and say, oh, I'm in the long run, and now this is time for this investment to pay. The long run is going to be a series of disciplined short terms. Now, and as I said, it's also a matter of alignment between a company and its investor base. I think that the long-term investors can afford and do afford companies the time to make those investments. Think about the pharmaceutical industry, for instance, and forget about ESG. Do the investors expect returns from pharmaceutical companies? Of course they do. But they also understand that those multi-billion R&D budgets are not going to pay off the next day. You cannot come up with a blockbuster drug within a week, right? Or within a quarter even. So I think what we need to note here is that perhaps a good chunk of the investors are realizing that the right way, in my view, to look at the integration of environmental and social issues into strategy is that long-term horizon, and stop calling it and move away from the, let's say, the language of costs and start talking about the language of investment when it comes to how integrate these issues. And once we do that, then we can better communicate to investors why is it that we're making those investments. And that's a good disciplinary mechanism, because when do you make investments? Well, obviously you make investments in stakeholders or processes that are critical or are material for your business model. So that external accountability is not necessarily bad. Of course, yeah, you might have excessively short-term investors, but look what's happening. Even hedge funds out there are coming out these days and saying, well, we're going to be activists in the ESG space because we consider it a risk. So I think those are all indications about the changing mind frame of the markets. But I would say that although there might be advantages in the private space, for instance, look at Mars. They're doing a range of groundbreaking initiatives as a private company. You can also see groundbreaking initiatives like Unilever, for instance, which was a public company. I'm not sure I would draw such a black and white distinction between private versus public, at least until I see at least some evidence, because I see reasons why, you know, different companies could thrive under a private context and different reasons why companies could thrive under a public context.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned Unilever, but it came under substantial pressure when from Warren Buffett and others, and decidedly linked to its sustainability strategy. Assets have been shed, you know, and there has been, you know, it's a significant factor. You seem more optimistic about, do you not worry about the short-term nature of many investors? And you mentioned the pharmaceutical industry, and I'm not familiar with the with figures recently, but I have heard of trends where the actual R&D is going down, or the actual real research side of it, and you know you do see again and again pressures, people talking in the press and companies talking about the pressures of investors short-term horizon.
Yes, of course I'm worried, because as I said, not all investors are the same, and you still find to this day investors that say, you know, it's all about shareholder value. I don't care about anything else. Now, the thing is, these investors, and that's, by the way, the role of regulation and institutions that kicks in. It's important to understand that, you know, even investors don't operate in a vacuum. So, for instance, if we were to have clear commitments as a society, as governments, towards carbon emission reductions, if, like the UK, for instance, the government institute a law that says by 2050 we're going to be carbon zero, then it is I would argue it's impossible for an investor to ignore this, because it has profound implications on the companies they invest in, even if they are shorter. The fact that we're moving towards carbon markets, for instance, and better pricing of of carbon emissions. Look at all this discussion that's happening at the EU level. If we do get to a legislation where we have a carbon border tax, for instance, that's going to be very short term. Even for the more short term of investors, that's going to have implications about even the pricing of products and services or the pricing of inputs. So I think that although they do exist, and there are also investors that greenwash. That's certainly true. And there are investors that, although they claim they do things, they don't actually have the sophistication, the knowledge, the skills, or the experience to do things. So I'm not in it. Just to be clear, I'm not defending any particular investor here or the investor community as a whole. I just see the, as I said, the direction of travel. It doesn't mean that all of them are traveling at the right speed. But that applies to companies as well. Companies greenwash too, and governments greenwash as well. So, you know, it's the challenge here is, as our understanding of sustainability becomes more and more sophisticated and more complex, to be able to hold them to account, especially those that make public commitments. For instance, look at what happened with BlackRock. They came out last year very, you know, publicly making commitments. And then you had NGOs like ShareAction come in and say, well, wait a second, you said this, you'll do this, but actually your voting record is really bad. And we also have that accountability in with respect to companies, right? So, for instance, we have companies that say, you know, we are supporting, for instance, a reduction in carbon emissions. And behind the scenes, they are paying lobbying groups to lobby against environmental regulations. Now, these are pathologies that I think in the past they were more and more difficult to uncover, but they're becoming increasingly they're increasingly coming to the surface. So I think in that respect, I am optimistic, because as a society, perhaps we're developing those accountability mechanisms to hold even the largest of investor to account. Here's another example. Look at what is happening at Amazon. When a company comes out publicly and says, you know, I'm committing to the environment, but actually you're an employee from within, and you see that's not actually true, you speak up. You go out there and you say what's actually happening within the company and how solid or fickle that commitment is. And we do have the means to do that. I mean, even the whole idea of whistleblowing for governments is the same idea, right? When you make a public commitment and internal stakeholders see that that commitment is not true, they speak up, and now we have the mechanisms for them to speak up. So in that sense, I am optimistic, in the sense that it's not that I don't recognize these pathologies and these failures, as you mentioned earlier, from greenwashing to outright lying, not just from investors, from companies and governments. But I do have faith in the fact that perhaps because of social media, because of digitization, perhaps of sometimes laws and regulations, we are developing the mechanisms to hold them to account. And by the way, the activism is a big chunk of that as well. It feeds into that, right? It feeds into that in terms of holding everyone accountable to what we're saying. And I think that that's why we've seen the explosion of activism in recent years. It's yet another very important mechanism to hold to account. Now, if none of this happened, yes, I would be extremely worried about instances of greenwashing and fickle commitments. But I see in parallel, if you like, the development of these accountability mechanisms that that are a very, very positive development, and hopefully will help us eliminate these pathologies in the system.
Yeah, no, it's very interesting what you say, and the tremendous importance of investors. And yet, you know, the stock market in so many ways doesn't seem to be functioning in key ways. We have a carbon bubble. We have, you know, if the value of fossil fuel companies was taken into account, that, you know, what the value of the carbon that's actually in the ground and how much they can take out, you know, there's a massive carbon bubble there which is still there today. And we have, as you said, you know, notwithstanding the talk about investment portfolios and stuff, you know, big asset managers overseeing huge, hundreds of billions of dollars ongoing fossil fuel investments.
Absolutely, and absolutely, Fergal. But two things there. I think there's a sort of a corporate level issues here, and there is policy level issues here. First of all, corporate level, Well, it's exactly, you know, that's why the corporate graveyard is packed with once iconic brands, right? Companies in the long run tend to miss these disruptions, tend to be unable to grasp these disruptions. Look at Polaroid, look at Sears, look at Kodak. The list goes on and on and on. Now, in other words, especially for large successful companies like oil and gas, for instance, right? I would expect, and we do see, extreme amounts of inertia. Sometimes outright denial about where the world is going, fighting, right? That's why they some of them have sponsored climate change denial in the same way that tobacco companies were fighting a war against research on lung cancer, right? So I do expect to see profound levels of inertia in terms of companies being able to adapt. And I often label sustainability as the mother of all disruption, because it's a domain in which companies also lack the experience, the knowledge, and the skills to deal with the kind of issues that they have in front of them. So I'm not surprised that you know, as you said, there is a bubble in that, because first of all, I would expect huge resistance from the companies themselves. Now, the policy framework here, though, is very important, because finance is a very complex system and capital markets are a very complex system. And they're only now moving into a world where these environmental and social issues are being measured, are being accounted for as risks, and they become part of the bigger conversation. For example, the Paris Agreement, the Sustainable Development Goals. Now, why do you have these bubbles? Well, another reason at the policy level is that you have backtracking. Look what's happening in the US, for instance. The Trump administration has essentially dismantled the Environmental Protection Agency, backtracked significantly on environmental laws and regulations, backtracked significantly on actually went on to support the coal industry and so on. So if you have that kind of misguided or backtracking or confusing, at the very least, policy commitment, then it's hard to account for these factors, because they distort the timeline, right? Whereas in the Obama administration, it was clear the direction of travel, right, in terms of reducing carbon emissions, becoming more environmentally responsible. Now the direction of travel has reversed, and risks are not, you know, accounted for in a vacuum. Risks are accounted for, among other things, against policy, right? And if policy seems to be so confusing, then risk cannot be fully measured, accounted for, and integrated. And it's not just the US, by the way. There's many countries around the world. Look at Australia, for instance. Now, if you want to account for risk, what do you know? At the very least, you need a price for carbon. Well, yeah, but we don't have fully functioning carbon markets because countries cannot agree. Why cannot they agree? Well, because there is this problem of coordination in each one of them looking at their individual interests, which means we fail in a global governance perspective.
But if maybe, Yanis, when it comes to carbon, maybe carbon markets aren't the way forward. I mean, there is this theme continuing that, you know, markets are the answer. You know, we create markets for carbon and so forth. And, you know, really not enough perhaps going on in terms of regulation.
Well, yeah, but the problem with regulation, Fergal, is that the world is not one jurisdiction. It's the same with tax regulation. It's not going to fix everything, because then you have a race to the bottom by countries, right? That's again, a problem of governance, whether you want to see it as a tax or regulation. The fact that the world is not one jurisdiction, it gets us back to the same problem again.
That may be the case, but the US is very influential. You know, there are some key players that drive forward, you know, the way that set the context and the theme for these kind of issues. But, you know, I do hear what you're saying. But I guess it brings up this question of, there's a lot of talk now about, you know, changes in capitalism, changes in the way companies operate and so forth. And I'm just wondering this question, you know, are companies, as they've evolved today, fit for purpose? We talked about some aspects of, you know, some issues, shall we say, at least with respect to the way the investors relate and their desire for and the way companies need to maximize their, you know, return to shareholders and so forth. There are other issues in terms of the kind of the payment packages that senior executives are getting. Perhaps you could talk also about the reduction in competition in huge sex swathes of America and other countries too, more oligopolistic. some issues that are need to be addressed. How do you frame that and think about that?
I don't think that companies are fit for purpose. And I think this goes back to what I discussed earlier about sustainability as a disruption. It's going to be, it is already a major disruption for businesses. And the issue is that a lot of them are still in denial about the extent and the depth and the speed and the magnitude of this disruption. So it is going to hit them. So I think the story of sustainability at the corporate level is going to be a dual story where some companies, and I think this is going to be in the long run, the minority of companies, will be able to adapt in this new world where environmental and social issues are a bit worsened, but they're also critical from a business point of view. So that the one part of the story is going to be adaptation. And as always, a big chunk of this story is going to be a story of replacement, is going to be a story of new companies coming in, understanding perhaps better the conditions that ESG is creating and taking over the markets. For instance, there is going to be, and you can see this duality playing again. Look at Tesla and traditional automobile makers who are constrained by their existing investments in fossil fuel cars. Can they move at the speed and at the rate of Tesla? That's something that is to be determined, right? We don't know yet. That battle is being played out as we speak. Think the food industry and the battle over, you know, meat. We see the Impossible Foods of the world, or the Beyond Meat of the world, coming in and exploding and then competing with traditional meat companies. So that's the kind of battle that I would expect to play out. And it's a good battle to be had, because it will, in a sense, accelerate perhaps the adaptation by existing companies, and those that are going to be able to adapt are going to be able to survive, but also shows us the feasibility, if you like, of some of these future solutions. So there is no, again, one answer that all of them are or all of them are not fit for purpose, but what I do expect us to see through the lens of disruption is that it's going to be this continuous story that we will see played out in other industries as well, in terms of new entrants coming in, really revolutionizing industries by being founded at very at the beginning with these principles in mind. And then the existing, especially existing large successful companies, as always, are going to have a big challenge in terms of adaptation. It's not impossible, but it's going to be difficult.
That's very interesting. Very interesting. I wonder also about this question, of growth. Growth is it's like motherhood and apple pie. It's more than that. It's what am I trying to say? Growth is essential in the corporate world. Is that compatible with sustainability?
The traditional way of talking about growth seems to me that it isn't. And I call it traditionally, though, because now we do have those very important conversations about what's really growth and development. And I think that is the bigger debate about, is GDP the right measure of growth, for instance? Are there any other things that we should take into account, for example, that capture better the quality of life of people, things like happiness and emotional health and so on, and mental health? So I think that the short answer, because it's a big, big debate, but the short answer to your question is that traditional notions of financial-only driven growth is arguably incompatible. But I do think that even there, even in those very established macro measures, if you like, we do have, and there are conversations and there are raised doubts about how to get to new measures that really capture true growth and human development, accounting for all aspects of an individual. An indication that, you know, as a world, perhaps, and as a society, we are now opening very fundamental conversations that perhaps were not on the table 5-10 years ago. And my view, again, this is my optimistic self now. You see how there's this multi-level alignment of stars, if you like, in this domain. I choose to be optimistic today. So.
Robert Kennedy talked about this quite some time ago. It has been around for a while, but it's hard to escape some sense that, you know, disaggregating, looking at 2.5, maybe a little bit more percent growth per annum in a country. If you look at that, that's looking at doubling the overall scale of output over 25 years. And if we look at just how burdened and damaged so many our ecosystems are, the actual material impact of that. So we're talking about twice the level of output today over the next 25 years. That's staggering.
It absolutely is. And that brings into account brings into focus, I guess, this dimension of sustainability, which has to do with optimization of our use of resources. So, for example, the whole industry of waste management, the whole kind of groundbreaking idea of moving into a circular economy where we use and reuse those resources. We see continuous experimentation in material science with new materials that can replace either the carbon intensive or resources that are harmful for us. I think there are a lot of developments in those kind of science-based domains that allow us to be optimistic, Fergal. I don't want to suggest that, you know, innovation is going to be the silver bullet and the human civilization is going to survive and everything will be great again. I'm not that optimistic, especially if one sees our use or overuse of resources and the fact that we're nowhere near where we should be in terms of carbon reduction to avoid catastrophic climate change. Again, these are pieces of the puzzle. And you know, if you want me to wear my pessimistic hat on, I am profoundly, profoundly saddened, if you like, or concerned by the fact that although we do observe change at the macro level, at the micro level in markets and so on, the issue is that the level and the speed of change are not nearly enough. So I would welcome and I want us and all of us to have a conversation about what kind of measures, what sorts of institutions, and I think we need new global institutions, what sorts of institutions do we need to account for, you know, our past perceptions, like the ones you mentioned earlier, like growth, and how do we measure growth, how do we measure human development, how does that translate for business policy, to have that conversation about how we can sort of coordinate to get there. Some days I'm optimistic that we might be able to do that. Sometimes I'm pessimistic. Because it depends on the day. But at least that's the problem.
Yes. You talk about momentum and speed of change. Now, I don't quite know the statistics here, but they talk about, you know, 90 companies causing 2/3 of man-made global warming emissions. I'm just wondering, why can't we get these 90 CEOs into a room, maybe in different several rooms or in different countries spread around the world, but bring them into a room to affect massive change?
Well, that's a very nice question, but I think we could bring them into this room, but that's not the only people that we would need. The CEOs and their companies do not operate in a vacuum. This is a systems level problem that will require many stakeholders in the room, a lot of which we discussed today. Think about the energy transition, the infrastructure growth, and perhaps rebuilding that we would need, the institutions that we discussed earlier, the role of us as consumers, as employees in these organizations. I wish there were easy solutions like that where we could bring 90 people in the room and make it happen, but it's not going to happen. And also, Fergal, let's keep in mind, I mean, don't get me wrong, I do think that climate change is the most pressing existential challenge the world has ever seen in recent years, but it's not the only challenge. How about the social issues? How about the issues of income inequality, poverty, hunger, and all those things? Those are not going to be fixed by 90 companies and their carbon emissions. So I really wish there was a simple solution like that. As I mentioned it, even at the beginning of this interview, I do profoundly believe in the the impact that business can have, but it cannot do it on its own. It has to be all the stakeholders. And by the way, I don't like the usually the, some of the questions be posed by others is, oh, it's either this or that or that. It's not an either or. We cannot afford to make a choice right now. It's all of the stakeholders that need to be in the room, essentially, and on the table.
Excellent. What's next for you, Yanis?
I'm actually, as I call it, in a period of rebalancing. So I'm launching this year a 5-week online program with LBS. It's called Sustainability Leadership and Corporate Responsibility. I'm very excited because we already have people on the waiting list and we are at least a month before launch. So I'm hoping for multiple cohorts a year, a course in which I've shared all of my knowledge, experience, and engagement that I've had over the last 10 or so years. And within LBS, I'm also launching a couple of other initiatives, a new elective where finance meets sustainability, finance meets strategy on sustainability issues, a new experiential week for our LBS students in the Nordics to see sustainability on the ground. I'm increasing the level of engagement that I have in terms of speaking and consulting with companies in order to transfer the impact, transfer the knowledge, if you like, and have an impact out there. And my goal is to bring my research even closer to real-world phenomena, dilemmas, and essentially difficult decisions and trade-offs that businesses and investors are facing. In terms of my research, I focus on these big questions, for instance, sustainability as a strategy, but also I'm interested in understanding yet another key stakeholder, which is the role of the customers in terms of the product and service markets and what are the implications that they have on companies' sustainability initiatives and that the whole idea of activism, consumers as activists, it's a big chunk of that. And finally, slowly but steadily at the back of my mind, I'm developing a very interest an interest in the intersection of AI, big data, and sustainability. I think there are huge synergies in terms of optimizing decisions, better prediction models, understanding underlying complex data. And I think that if you were to ask me what's a field within sustainability to keep an eye on, I would definitely identify the intersection of sustainability and these new technologies as something that I expect very soon to break through because there are tremendous potential there. And that's something that, again, I follow and I keep in the back of my mind.
Well, you've got a very full plate there, Yanis. Thank you so much for your time today. That was a very spirited and very, very interesting discussion. And I wish you all the best of success with your ongoing work.
Thank you so much for having me. As always, it's been a true pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Sustainability Agenda podcast. I hope you found it interesting. It would be great if you could leave a review and share the podcast on social media. You can sign up at iTunes to make sure you don't miss any future episodes.